Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Elise Glink Show, live on Sundays, 11 to 1, football season, on News Talk WSB. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK, online, website, thinkglink.com. So this week, my husband Sam and I have been going online and looking at healthcare plans. And many of you know who've listened to the show for a long time that Sam and I have been buying our own healthcare for the entire time that we have been married, which is 24 plus years. And it is outrageously expensive. And I don't know if I've ever told you exactly how much we pay, but the total bill just for our premiums, and this is not a really fancy policy, I just have to say. It has a relatively low deductible, but the policy that we have now costs us somewhere north of $30,000 a year. And then we have our deductibles, and then we have whatever, you know, portion of the insurance that we have to pay, and we're very, very fortunate in that we can afford to pay it. But I got to tell you, it's pretty expensive. And so when the health care law passed, the Affordable Care Act, the exchange started up. Sam was one of the first people online to take a look and see what it was going to do for us, because we are relatively healthy people, folks. I am telling you that aside from slightly high cholesterol, we are really healthy people. But in the eyes of insurance companies, what passes for health doesn't really mean you're healthy. Or if you are healthy, what passes for, you know, what they consider to be, you know, problems that, you know, pre-existing conditions and all the rest of it, it's enough to make you really crazy, and it costs a lot of money. And so for the last, what we used to do is, you know, is we would just sort of get new plans. We would re-qualify for new and different groups, less expensive. And then we got to a place where we couldn't do that anymore. And so we got stuck, like millions of Americans with health insurance, paying an ever-spiraling cost that is extreme and would be way too much for most people. So that's just the choice that we made. You know, even in years where it was less affordable for us, boy, health insurance and going with that, it was never an option. And so we were really pleasantly surprised to go on to healthcare.gov and see that our premiums are likely going to fall by half, by 50%, maybe even more. Yes, we have to take a higher deductible, and that's not a problem for us. We'll absolutely do that. But it's an amazing opportunity for us to get it. And I want to tell this story because I'm starting to do more with health insurance, and because health insurance is really a subset of what I talk about every single week on this show, which is taking care of yourself and your family. When you look at the reasons people get divorced, it's a huge amount of it is financial, and of the financial problems that we have, a huge number of those are driven by health care, uninsured health care costs. And so for people to get health insurance is really amazing. Our housekeeper, who is Mexican and has been in this country for a long time and is a citizen, has never had health insurance. And last week she was navigating it and printing out papers, and Sam was helping her understand what it was, and she was just thrilled. She's going to get health insurance for the first time. Now, the healthcare.gov website isn't working great, I got to say. But what is working, and I spent some time this week because in Chicago, I'm actually hosting a healthcare summit for small business owners. The rules and regulations for small business owners is different than it is for individuals. And as a small business owner myself, I'm always thinking about, you know, what am I going to do and how can I provide for my employees and, you know, do what I can for them. But you can only afford to do so much. You know, I'm like every other small business owner in America. I have to think about, you know, I can't go broke paying for health care insurance or none of them will have jobs. That's a bigger worry, right? So we're still figuring out what to do, but I'm hosting this healthcare summit for small business owners, and so I've been spending a lot of my time talking to different insurers about what they can do. And so one thing that struck me as sort of interesting this week, and I pass this along because I'm hearing from a lot of you, you're sending emails to thinklink.com, and you're concerned, and you're curious, and you don't know what to do, and all the rest. The biggest wow I had this week is that if you can't get through to healthcare.gov, and for some reason you can't get through to, you know, a state plan in Georgia, you can still go to the individual insurance companies and look up your state, and then they will tell you all the different plans that they have. And you can compare and contrast the plans that way. And it's fascinating to me. This is a couple of things, right? Number one, the insurance companies, of course, are getting this right, and healthcare.gov is not getting this right yet. Number two, the insurance companies don't have to then connect back through all the different tax, you know, the IRS and, like, Medicare, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and about 10 other government organizations, so it's a little bit easier for them. But it's pretty clear when you go onto an insurer's website that what you're getting and then how you can start to compare and contrast. And really it's going to come down to a couple of things. What do you want your deductible to be? What can you afford? Because the lower the deductible, the higher the cost. That's just how it has always worked. But getting the coverage is really amazing. And so having this opportunity to sort of explore it, if you can just get past the whole website nonsense, as Sam and I have done, by simply going around it, we looked at ehealthinsurance.com, and it showed us all the plans in the country. And so then you know what insurers are actually participating. And then you can go to the insurer's website and put in your state, and it comes right up. Right? So I guess it's a workaround. And, yes, the main website should work better, and it doesn't. But, you know, don't let that stop you. You know, my whole career, I've always been about empowering yourself to get the answers that you need and not let other people get in the way of you understanding what you need to put on the table for your family. Insurance is just one of those tools that you have to figure out, whether it's term life insurance or whole life insurance, right? I mean, talk about a can of worms there. Like, just the jargon that's there is just so off-putting. Like, it just smacks you in the face. And you think, how am I going to ever sort through this? But you do, because you know that if something happens to you, you need insurance to be there for your family. What I don't want to see are any more families bankrupt by the fact that they just can't get insurance. And I have to tell you, it has just been so disheartening for Sam and for me for all these years that we have paid these ever-escalating prices, and because we couldn't qualify for any other policies because we were considered to have a pre-existing condition, in which in the case of it was with Sam, was he had a bulging disc in his back. And suddenly that meant we were uninsurable. So for those of you who are worried about your current plans expiring at the end of the year and you're not going to be able to log on, our insurance company said to us, your plan is expiring, but we are grandfathering you in. So as long as you have your plan and you keep paying your premiums, you can have it. But, you know, when you're done, this plan is going to go away. It no longer meets the 10 essential health benefits of Obamacare. It no longer, you know, X, Y, and Z. There were three pages of nonsense I couldn't follow. I mean, I could, but I had to go back and really think about it. But basically what they were saying to us is this plan is over. This plan is over, and there are new plans, and now there are no pre-existing conditions. And you and Sam are going to be able to get health insurance that's going to provide coverage. I don't need all of the coverage that's being provided. You know, my days of having more kids like Alex and Michael, I think, are gone. But it is what it is. This is what I'm going to be able to do. And I was just thrilled to see that it's going to cost me less, a lot less, than it has cost over the last 5 years. So I want everybody to take advantage and figure out what's going to be best for you. And if you need health insurance that you don't think that you're just stuck by only going to healthcare.gov, and if that doesn't work, you're out of luck. It's not true. There are ways and workarounds. You just have to be a little bit inventive on how you're going to investigate. But as I said, if you go to ehealthinsurance.com, it lists all of the plans that are available in Georgia. I went and looked earlier this week. And then you can go to the individual insurers' websites like BlueCrossBlueShield.com or Humana.com or Aetna.com or Kaiser.com, whoever it is that's offering plans, and you can actually see what the different plans are and start to understand what's going to work for you. And I hope you do that because really, as I have said for my entire career, nobody cares more about your money than you do. Nobody. There's no insurance agent, and there's no banker, and there's no mortgage lender. Nobody cares as much about your money as you do. You're the one who works for it. You're the one who does without for it. You're the one who suffers for it. You save it. You don't spend it. You watch it grow. You nurture it. You care about it. And insurance is just one of the bigger subsets of our personal finances that you've got to grab by the throat and make to work for you, because nobody else is going to do it for you. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. It's 18 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with more Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB. It's 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Kling Show. Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You can follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Joanne joins me on the line. Hi, Joanne.
Hello, hi. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. What's going on today?
I wanted to know, I had a question. My mom got a letter. She's a senior citizen. She's about 73. And she got a letter saying that she will have to shop for Obamacare. I have not read the letter yet, but is that true? Senior citizens also have to go online to shop for a plan?
No, it's not true. Is she on Medicare?
She's on Medicaid.
Medicaid. She's on Medicaid?
She has a red, white, and blue card.
There are seniors in some states who are getting letters that are telling them that they actually have to go buy Affordable Care Act, buy plans on the exchange or get some sort of coverage, but it's not true. If you're on Medicare or Medicaid, that isn't what's going on. If you're Medicare eligible, you are right now in the Medicare enrollment period, which goes till December 7th for prescription drug plans, and everybody who's on that has to choose. But no, if your mom is on Medicaid, that she's not part of this. In fact, there's so few people, relatively speaking, who are trying to do this right now. 80% of Americans are already covered with health insurance, either by the government because of Medicare or Medicaid, or they work for the government, or by their own plans, their work plans. So, no, she doesn't have to do that. I would love to know what it actually says, Joanne, in that letter, but she does not need to do that. She can call the local Medicaid office, and she can talk to them about it, or you can do it for her. But if you already are on Medicare, and it's confusing why anybody's getting these letters, but it isn't the first time we're going to be confused by the government, and it certainly won't be the last time. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America One House at a Time. Starting with yours, when we come back, we're going to cover a little bit more about this health care. We'll take some of your calls. And then I want to talk about the $13 billion settlement. We're going to get to this at some point in time today. The $13 billion that JPMorgan Chase is being asked to pay to settle more allegations that they were selling bad home loans to hedge funds and to other kinds of places during the the home crisis. So we will get to all of that and more. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Plank, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show. We're on today 9 to 11 to accommodate the football schedule. Next week, we'll be back to 12 to 2. So it goes through December, and then we'll settle back into 11 to 1. It's crazy. 11:36 today on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. The number to call, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online with Twitter, at Glink, or you can find me online at thinklink.com. We also, there's just all kinds of ways to get involved with the ThinkLink community. So try it. You might like it. Want to talk about J.P. Morgan Chase. So this has been a really interesting settlement negotiation. So last week we heard about how J.P. Morgan Chase was going to be paying $13 billion, which is about half of its profit for all of last year. $13 billion to settle claims with the federal government, various branches relating to home loan and mortgage-backed securities the company sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's a $13 billion accord. Late on Friday, J.P. Morgan agreed to pay $5.1 billion just to settle the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA, claims relating to it. So what does that include? It's just so much money. The deal includes $4 billion to end the FHFA's 2011 lawsuit accusing J.P. Morgan of selling Fannie and Freddie faulty mortgage bonds. The remaining $1.1 settles the claims that the firm sold the company's defective loans that they packaged into their own securities. Let's deconstruct that for a minute, shall we? So what happened in the housing crisis? What happened was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac decided that, and this was in the run-up to it, right, that they wanted to have more profits, and they were out pushing lenders to do more loans, right? And that had been part, that didn't happen just starting in, like, say, 2003. I mean, that had been steadily part of the plan from the early 90s. When the head of Fannie Mae at the time, Jim Johnson, stood up at a conference that I was at and said, you know, we think A-minus credit is just as good as A, and we're going to start doing that. So they were already expanding their horizons. And then you had banks and others start to see that profits could really be juiced by selling more and more loans. And so they went ahead and did that without... and stop paying attention to things like, well, affordability or payback. Can you actually afford to pay back this loan? Well, who cares? If we give you a pay option arm, meaning you can decide how much you want to pay, on paper it looks like you could afford to pay it. And that never kind of looked at what would come home to roost later on. So J.P. Morgan Chase is the latest bank to have a multi-billion dollar charge, right? And they are now seeking to settle state and federal probes. Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, is trying to get it all settled. And kudos to him, because really, you just want to get this settled. Here we are, 5 years after the housing crisis, and we're still talking about who did wrong, what went wrong, and there are millions and millions of homeowners out there who have suffered, right? There are the people who have gone through foreclosure, short-sailed their houses, and then you have all of their neighbors, people like you, who maybe tried to do everything right and kept paying and kept doing, keeping your house fixed up, and your house fell through the floor value-wise because of everything else that was going on. I would argue that almost everybody in America was hurt by the housing crisis. Almost everybody. In one way, shape, or another. Just like whenever you talk to people about who's been hurt with unemployment, right? Who did the Great Recession hurt? Do you know somebody who is out of a job or who had lost a job or who had financial setbacks? Everybody raises their hand. We all know people like that. Everybody has been hurt, and it's scary, and there are times when you feel it's never going to get better. And so this whole country, this whole world has been hurt by how the banks handled certain things and how the government also handled certain things. And that's just what we're trying to settle. And so there's no way to get people their houses back. There's no way to get jobs back that were lost. There's still 5 million people out there unemployed compared with prior to the recession. It's just a steep decline. And we're fighting our way back. And really, the only thing that's truly back is the stock market. But okay, we're going to set that aside. So JPMorgan Chase is the latest bank. And this isn't the first time that they've already gone through this, right? They've kicked in other cash before. But late Friday, they agreed to pay $5.1 billion to settle this claim with the FHFA. And now they're trying to get the rest of the $8 billion settled. So the $4 billion that's going to go to Fannie and Freddie is important, right? Did the company misrepresent the quality of mortgage bonds packaged and sold at the height of the U.S. housing boom? J.P. Morgan is not going to admit wrongdoing. They may have to admit some wrongdoing at the other part of the settlement, but at this point, no. And so what they're trying to do is take it down. Now, what was really interesting, if you read the news reports on this, is that JPMorgan Chase has put away something like $28 billion to settle claims and wrongdoing and legal bills and all the rest. And their legal bill is somewhere, I can't even believe this is true, somewhere around $7 billion right now. I thought they had lawyers on staff. I guess this is the outside counsel. Anyway, it's a lot of money. The big concern when I looked at the $13 billion settlement is just $4 billion of it is going to go to homeowners who have been wronged somehow. And that doesn't take into account what's happened to everybody else. What's happened to your house and the value. And yes, values are coming back. Honestly, faster than I thought they would. Usually, homes don't move this fast. Home value doesn't move quickly. Stock markets move quickly. And we've seen a tremendous dive and growth. Excuse me. But home value doesn't move quickly. So why is home value moving so quickly now? There are some new theories about how home values are changing. And that this volatility, and guess what? When home values jump up or fall down quickly, it's volatility. It's what we use, terms that we use to describe the stock market. So home value volatility is increasing in part because, this is how the theory goes, hedge fund money and other private equity money is coming in a big way. And is able, with investors swooping up and buying these houses, able to stop home values from deflating in their tracks. And at the same time, boost or support home values that are moving up. And it can happen on a dime, which is very scary. It should be very scary to you. It's terrifying for me. Because if you look back historically over, 700 or 800 years, which is what Robert Shiller, the new Nobel Prize-winning economist, has done, and you look at housing crises over around the world, and there have been plenty of them, it usually takes a long time for prices to come back. And here we see housing prices jump. They've jumped like 10, 12, 15%. 25% in some cases over the last year, year over year, October to now. Even in Atlanta, home prices in some neighborhoods are up 25% in a year. How does that happen? It doesn't happen because people are moving in at the bottom and they're sucking up, you know, and just natural forces. What's happening is large swaths of homes at the very bottom echelon are being taken off the market. And so then prices rise up to the next lowest level, and those are all being taken off the market. And they're being taken off the market by investors at a much more rapid pace. They're taking them off the market. They're gulping them down. They're swallowing them. Neighborhoods betting that they won't be the last ones in. And that's why you hear some talk about another bubble coming, and that's nerve-wracking, and people don't know where that's going. So we do want to get through this, right? I want you to see your home value rising. Trust me, I am not suggesting home value should stay low for anybody's sake. I think what's interesting is this notion that we can solve these problems and fix housing markets, but if there is this concern that they are now going to be much more volatile and that we're going to see massive price swings up and down, it changes how all of us have to think about our houses. It has to change what we do to our houses and the improvements we make in it. Because even if you're going to stay 30 years in a house, which nobody ever knows and nobody seems to be doing these days, even if you're going to stay, the quality of the investment changes. And what you used to be able to count on, you might no longer be able to. And if that truly comes to pass, we are going to see residential real estate take on an entirely new character, and it is going to really change how we see it as part of our portfolios and part of our financial lives and part of our investments. And maybe it won't be the thing that increases just over the rate of inflation like it has for the last 50 or 100 years. Maybe house prices will be something else entirely. We'll see. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. I'm Elise Glenk. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glenk is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Yeah. 54 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glenk Show. Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Next hour, we are going to talk about a new law being debated in Congress. Well, it'll eventually get debated in Congress, about what your credit report should include. And if your credit score should include your rent and your cable bills and all of the other bills that go into figuring out what makes you credit worthy or not. So it's a bill in Congress. It is talking about how to revamp the three-digit number known as a credit score. And if it should include non-loan payments, this is a really important discussion that I think we're going to hear a lot more about this year. And there are all kinds of people and companies on both sides of this question. And I think you would be surprised to learn a little bit about how the credit scoring and credit monitoring and credit history worlds actually work. Now, full disclosure, I am the managing editor for the Equifax Finance blog, which has 1,000 pages of free information, more than 1,000 by now, at blog.equifax.com. And it explains in great detail all about how your credit history works today. This conversation is about how it might work in the future, and I think it's really important to think about that and understand how credit works. Credit is still so confusing for so many people, and I think we're just going to see all kinds of things change. So I'll talk about that a little bit after the news next hour. Hope you'll stay with me for that. 404-872-0750. Tony joins me on the line from Maryland. Hi, Tony.
Hey, how's it going?
Things are good. How can I help today?
Well, I've got a question about a condo, which I rent out. We recently discovered a water leak, which was hidden behind the shower faucet, and it damaged the neighbor's drywall underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, who's responsible for repairing the drywall of the neighbor? Would it be me, the landlord, or my tenant that operated the faucet and caused the leak?
Well, first of all, what does your lease say?
I mean, I know the condo documents, though, I know say that, you know, if there is any sort of, you know, it is my pipe, and, you know, in the end, the landlord's responsible for it according to the condo documents.
Okay. Well, then that's very clear that in the condominium discussion, you are responsible. Now, if your tenant, for example, and this is a true story that I heard from somebody, may have even been on the show now that I think about it, tenant ran a bath and just left it for like 8 hours. And the bathtub obviously overflowed and all over the neighbors, and it kind of destroyed the neighbor's ceiling. So who was responsible for that? Well, the landlord is responsible in terms of being the condo owner. Whether you can get some payback from the tenant for bad behavior is another story altogether. But a leak behind a faucet isn't something that, unless it was caused by directly, you know, it's something that stupid, like the tenant just lets the faucet run and it overflowed, I think you would have a hard time making the case that it was the tenant's bad behavior that caused it. But maybe it is. I mean, you're going to have to, you know, answer that for yourself. But in terms of the condo association, you are responsible. It's your pipe. You're responsible for fixing the leak and the damaged drywall. 59 minutes past the hour on the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. We're going to talk about credit scores. We're going to talk about mortgage interest rates, which fell to the lowest level in about, I don't know, 4 months? Really good news if you want to be refinancing. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Klink is on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time. Website, thinklink.com, and Twitter is at Klink, where we're already having a conversation about things. So one of the things I wrote about this week is how unaffordable housing is becoming in some areas. And so this is what I was talking about just a little bit ago, where we've seen this past year home prices rise 25% in some marketplaces. Now, it's not your house that rose 25%, but it might have been if you were had fallen all the way down 50, 60%, and then now you're up 25% over where you were a year ago. But we're talking about, you know, it's sort of a global thing, and by global I mean very local, but global in a local sense, if that makes any sense. So it's all about what goes on in your neighborhood, and as I've often said, or real estate agents often say, location, 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 right? Location, what city you're in, location, what neighborhood you're in, location, where you are on your block. All of those things come together, and they really have an impact on affordability and on cost and value and neighborhood stability and all the rest. So what we saw over the last, you know, from, say, 2007 or 8, depending on where you lived in the country, up until maybe last year, is home prices falling and falling and falling. And then we saw rock-bottom interest rates following the financial crash, and that helped keep property cheap, even though property prices started to rise. When you're getting a 30-year fixed-rate loan at 3.5%, which, by the way, you're not, although it's a little bit over that now, because it's come down again. We'll talk about that in a bit. It's still affordable, even if your income isn't really rising all that much. If your income is going up 3% a year, which is what it did from last year to this year, and home prices have gone up 15 or 20% last year to this year, guess what? Homes are becoming unaffordable for most Americans. And now that the market has started to recover, home prices and interest rates are going up, and your income simply isn't keeping pace. Not keeping pace. It's becoming unaffordable to own a home again. Just a few years a couple of years after the worst housing crisis in almost 100 years. A median income household, so this, it's the middle point of incomes, same number above as below. That's what median is as opposed to average. A median income household can afford a median priced home in only 8 of 25 of the largest cities in the U.S. 8 of 25. Last year, 14 of these cities had a more affordable housing markets. What you are seeing, and what I wrote on CBS News this week, is the amount of money that people could afford to borrow, or the size of the mortgage they could afford, actually declined in all 25 cities. That's what Mike Sante said. He's the managing editor of Interest.com, which is part of Bankrate.com. The amount of money that you could afford to borrow, or the size of the mortgage you could afford to pay for, declined in all of the 25 largest cities in the U.S. Just think about what that means. Think about what that means for you. Right? And what is affordability? It isn't about spending every last dollar you bring home. It's the 28% rule, which is that homeowners should not spend any more than 28% of their gross income on their total housing costs. That is mortgage payments, homeowners insurance costs, and real estate property taxes. Those are the standards that the mortgage industry has used for years, 28 and 36. 28% on your total housing costs and 36% on your total debt. That means if you have a school loan, it's included. If you've got a car loan, it's included. Credit card debt, all of that is included. And yet, last year, mortgage interest rates rose up and it wiped out the minimal increase in people's income, which was about 3%. Last year, 30-year fixed rate mortgage climbed from 3.7% to 4.43%. It added about $84.50 to the monthly payment on a $200,000 mortgage and made it unaffordable. Because you're spending more of your income on housing costs. And when you add everything else in that you have to pay, like your cell phone bill and the cable bill and whatever it is, food. Food is another big piece of that, right? When you add all those things up together, and then you start tacking on an extra $80, $100 on a mortgage, it just suddenly becomes unaffordable. So San Francisco is once again the least affordable housing market in the U.S., higher than Miami, Los Angeles, New York, and San Diego. It's crazy. Home prices are soaring there. The median income of a household in San Francisco is only half as much as what's needed to buy the median price home. And somebody in San Francisco, and you've heard this for years, could spend twice as much of their income on housing than someone in Atlanta. Atlanta is the country's most affordable housing market. It's got lower than average property taxes, homeowners insurance costs, all of that contributes to the affordability. So a household in Atlanta is earning a median income of $54,000 and change, and can actually afford to buy a median-priced home costing about $143,000, assuming a 20% down payment. In fact, the median income in Atlanta actually exceeds the income threshold needed to afford a median-priced home for about 25%, which is great news, except that it means that home prices are still rising in Atlanta because there's deals to be had, and that's just how the market works. So it's interesting, and you can read that story. It's called As Income Stagnates, Housing Becomes Unaffordable. I'll tweet it in a moment so that you've got the link. You can follow me at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and on my Twitter account and get it there. But there are real changes coming and continuing to come. And the one good thing that's happened, and we'll talk about this more in a little bit, is that mortgage interest rates have come down again. And it's now back to being around 4%. It's come down almost 0.75% in the last 6 weeks. Interest rates are coming down. It's not in the 3%. Well, it's, I guess it was 3.98%. But You're talking about 4% when you factor in all the costs. Still historically cheap. But it's not 3% any longer. It's 4%. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Nancy joins me on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
What's going on today?
Thank you for letting me be online today.
Oh, I'm happy.
It's the first time I've ever been on a radio show.
Oh, well, we're happy to have you. Welcome.
I have a question about PMI. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I bought a house in Douglasville, Georgia, back in 2006 when I was able to get a teaching job in Paulding County. And at that time, I think we went to first option, and like our mortgage was about $158,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we bought the house for. Okay, and that there were some tagged on fees, and we didn't have much money down, but we both had incomes, and so they, you know, allowed us to buy the house. Well, right before the crash of the housing market, we refinanced our house through a broker who sold it to Wells Fargo, and there was about $3,800 in fees, so it made our mortgage go a little bit higher, basically about $161,000. 2009, when the crash really did happen, my husband was disabled from his job because he had a heart attack or a stroke, and we ended up talking to our bank instead of actually going, because at that time they didn't have the government HARP programs,
mm-hmm.
and so Wells Fargo was able to get us in touch with someone who cut our payments in half from like $1,200 a month to $650 a month, because we were living off of his disability checks while I was out of a job, because I lost my teaching job when the budget crashed, and you know they were firing teachers left and right because just could not hold on to that many teachers because of the state's budget.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, I believe that broker charged another $2,000 in fees, but it brought our interest rate and our payments down to really low, and they also had some part of our mortgage that wasn't going to be charged interest at all. But the thing is, right now, currently in 2013, and we've owned this house now for 7 years, we are down to a mortgage interest principal, or just a mortgage principal, of about $156,000. Now, Wells Fargo has done a good job in allowing us to keep paying that, but we have owned this house for 7 years and continue to pay $80 a month in PMI and have never been late on a payment, not even once. And, of course, because my house is probably now valued at about 140, my loan-to-value ratio, it's going to take another 5 more years
mm-hmm.
before I can ever, shall we say, take PMI off. So my question is there any way you can deal with that if you've been a good payer and you've always paid your mortgage payments on time, not once being late for 7 years, and still being charged PMI?
So, Nancy, I'm going to answer your question in just a moment. The obvious thing is that I don't think you understand what the purpose of PMI is, private mortgage insurance, and
mm-hmm.
I want to explain that when I explain what the answer is. Will you stay with me for a moment? We have to take a quick break, unfortunately.
Okay.
It is 18 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. 404-872-0750. I'll be back in a moment to answer Nancy's question and take a few more of yours on News Talk WSB. 25 minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours, 404-872-0750. So I was talking to Nancy from Douglasville, and Nancy, your story has really moved me because it's so emblematic of how people have been hurt in this Great Recession and with the housing crisis. You bought a house in 2006. You paid $158,000. Today, the house is worth maybe $140,000, and you've been paying all the while. Your husband has been disabled. You're trying to live on disability, and you want to know why you can't get rid of private mortgage insurance. And private mortgage insurance is the reason that you were able to get your house in the first place. If you hadn't bought it with private mortgage insurance, which covers the top 20% of a loan if you don't have 20% to put down, you would have never been able to buy that house, which actually, in retrospect, you might have thought that was a good, would have been a good thing. But you were able to use the creative financing techniques that many lenders had been offering to buyers like you, and you were fine until something bad happened. And for you, what was bad was that your husband had a heart attack and became disabled and was unable to work, and then you lost your job. It was like a big smack double whammy.
Yeah, all during the recession.
During the worst time to try and get a job. And, it, you know, when people say to me, well, those people, they don't really, you know, they don't want to work or they don't want to do this, I bet there'd be nothing that you would like better than to get another job and have paid your bills on time and not had to ask for help. And I get that, because it is just...
Well, the thing is, my husband did actually get to return to work. You know, it took 4 years almost, but he's actually back to work, and I'm ready to graduate with my second master's degree in mathematics and statistics, and I'm looking for a job this December.
Well, I can't imagine something better than a degree, a master's degree in math and statistics for getting a job these days, because it's all about big data, and statistics is all about crunching big data. So I think you're going to probably have really good luck. But to get to your question about PMI, unfortunately, there's nothing that you can do about it right now. The next time, you would have to have 20% down or in equity in this house, which you don't have, in order to be able to get rid of PMI. And it could be a long time before that happens. And it has nothing to do with whether or not you paid on time. It has everything to do with the terms of the agreement under which you got your mortgage. So I'm sorry I don't have better news for you. My good hope for you for the new year is you get an amazing job, and and you can afford to put down the 20% and then refinance and then get rid of PMI. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com at midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Minutes past the hour on the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750. It is 12:36. Glad you could join me today. Next week, I am on 12-2 because we've got football again. So pretty soon, football season will be over, and baseball season will be over too. We'll be on at our regular time. Glad you could join me today. We're going to do our prize pack coming back in just a few minutes. I want to take Danny's call. Danny's been waiting for a while. Danny, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thank you so much, Elise. I have a 14-year-old house. I have a mortgage on it for $163.
Mm-hmm.
I had a real estate agent last week, and the agent told me that as it is, it might bring $125 to $140.
Wow.
But it needs work. I need to make, well, here's my situation is I'm single. I've met someone that I'd like to marry. She had to short sell her house about 2 years ago, so she's out of a house. She's renting a place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I need to spend probably about $25,000 in repairs and upgrades to make this place decent for a woman to live in.
Oh, my gosh. That just sounds... I can only imagine how that looks.
Yeah, it needs carpet and painting and countertops, and it wouldn't hurt to have some new cabinets and everything. So, anyway, I'm upside down to start with, that amount. From 163, that she said maybe 125 to 140, and plus I need to spend probably about $25,000. I don't know if it makes. I'm thinking about just walking away from it. A strategic foreclosure, I think, is a nice way to say foreclosure. I mean, strategic default.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
but
what the ramifications
of that is. But it's killing you to say that, even to me. I hear it in your voice. Mm. You don't really want to do that.
No.
That's just not, I'm going to guess for you, that's just not how you were raised. And
no,
it doesn't...
I'm in my 50s, you're correct. And like the lady before, I've never, ever in my life been late on a mortgage payment. You know?
Right. So you've got great credit.
Yeah, I've got a 750 score.
So.
And I really feel stuck.
Yeah. Stuck is bad. Stuck is bad.
Yeah.
What is your intended fiance say about all this? Because surely you've had a conversation, right?
Well, she doesn't. I was married for, I've been divorced about 6 years, and so it's not my wife. My first wife lived here. My girlfriend now, she's not crazy about moving into the ex-wife's house, even though it's been a long time. So,
really? Does she feel like the ghost of your first wife is going to come haunt her in the middle of the night?
That's what I asked her. I said, which I've almost...
Halloween's only one day, right?
Pardon?
Halloween is only this week, right?
Well,
and then it's over.
Exactly. I think she's gotten over that. I think, but that was her initial response. And I told her, I said, besides, if we make these changes, they're going to be your colors and patterns anyway.
You know, when my mother remarried, my father died when I was, like, the week after my 18th birthday. And I've told that story before. But when my mother remarried 5 years later, he had some qualms about moving into our house. He didn't want it. He just felt a little strange about it, right? And so my mother said to him, listen, we'll redo the whole thing. It'll feel like a completely different apartment, but it's paid off. It's convenient. There's parking. It's close to, you know, what you do. It's close to what I do. And frankly, I don't feel like moving right now, but I want to marry you, and I know we'll be happy here. And it was the house, my mother was much younger, and we, while grown, were still, you know, in college, and my sisters were still coming home. And so she didn't want to rip out a house that they knew out from under them. And they talked about it. They actually had a real conversation about what that might look like and how it might be. And, you know, within a very short period of time, my stepfather got with the program and said, you know what, it makes a lot of sense to stay here. And they redid the house. It felt completely different. It felt very modern and nice. And about 2 seconds after moving in, it didn't even matter to him anymore. And I say that because it's, I think, very hard for people. And let's just take love and marriage and ex-spouses and kids and off the table. And let's just say that if you are going to look at a house, it is so hard to look past everybody's decorating to understand what it would be like to live there. Right?
Correct.
It's just really hard. People have a limited capacity to imagine a future in a place that looks like somebody else's life. So you go in and you know, this is why agents, there's a whole business called staging, right? Where people just get hired to come in and they remake a house so it looks more like a TV show set than a house that anybody lives there. And a lot of that has to do with taking out all the personal stuff and, you know, repainting everything white and making it clean and beautiful. And I'm guessing that if you did that, she'd be like, wow, this feels like a totally different place. Why don't we just stay? Now, I'm not saying you should make the $25,000 bet, but I am saying that if she loves you, maybe she loves you enough to have a real conversation about how the two of you might make these improvements and last another 5 years in this house, and then when you sell, you move somewhere that you both choose that's actually going to make sense for your next stage of your life. You said you're in your 50s. In another 5-10 years, you're going to be thinking about retiring. She'll be thinking about it. Maybe you don't want to retire in the house that you're in now. Maybe there's somewhere else you both want to go. But maybe what you do is reframe this conversation as the start and not the finish.
Absolutely. You're speaking my language. So I'm not totally nuts talking about putting that kind of money into a house I'm upside down in if the only other option is foreclosure, to tell you the truth.
Well, why would you... So here's the thing. If the house location still works for you and you still like it, and home prices in Atlanta, as I just talked about, are going up. They went up 20-something percent last year, year over year. What's really going to happen if you have another foreclosure in your neighborhood is that it's going to depress prices down. It's not going to bring them up. But you fixing up your house means that's one less foreclosure for sale in your neighborhood. It's one less foreclosure everybody has to deal with. It's better for everybody, and it's better for you. If you told me, Elise, I can't live in this neighborhood anymore, it's crime infested, I don't feel safe, I have young kids. I don't feel safe letting them play outside. We would be having a very different conversation. And if you listened to the show for a while, you would know that I would be like, foreclose, walk away from that house tomorrow. But that's not what you're telling me. You're telling me you still like it.
I like the house and I like the neighborhood. As a matter of fact, she likes the house in the neighborhood. But we just have been debating about, and like I told you before, I think we've gotten beyond the emotional part about my former wife living. I mean, I'm so far beyond that.
Well, it's been 6 years. It seems sort of, right? 6 years, did you say?
Yes. Uh-huh.
It seems silly. Now, if you told me you still have pictures of you and your wife and your wedding picture up on the mantle, I'd be like, you know, Danny, you're not really over it.
Right. Oh, yes.
You're not over her, but you're not saying that either. So here's the thing. If your intended likes it, I think the best wedding present you could give her is to say, look, you would probably be paying $25,000 a year to rent your place next year. Let's take your money and you tell me how you want to spend it to make this house our house for the next 5 to 7 years. And then if you still want to move, and we want to move, we'll make this decision together, and we will take our time, and we will go make that move somewhere else, anywhere you want to go, and just put it in her hands. And I think that what she is feeling is a lack of control, right?
Yeah.
And you want to give her control. You love her, right? So if you give her the decision, and you just say, look, this is a temporary thing, 5 years is going to fly by. But let's make this house beautiful, and in 5 years, I'm pretty sure your house isn't going to be underwater anymore. And it's not really any more money on top of it, right? Because she would be spending that money renting. So now you're going to be living together.
Absolutely.
So you've got, it's like a built-in savings. You're taking her first year of rent, and the two of you are going to spend it to make this house your joint home.
Indeed.
Your future home. And then she's going to feel like she gets to call it. You probably don't care what color the kitchen cabinets are.
Care less.
Yeah. So do I.
As long as she's happy with it, I'm happy with it.
Exactly. You care that you come home and the two of you, you know, open up a nice bottle of wine and have a meal and share your lives together. And I think that in making this proposal to her, if you hand her this control, Danny, she is going to say, I'm scared, but I'm all in. And then you say, tell me what you're scared about. Let's put it all on the table. Let's solve this one piece at a time. Because I don't know what went wrong with your last marriage, but I will tell you that the best marriages I know, and I count my own in this of 24 years plus, is when you can sit down and say, let's just work it out. Let's put all the scary fears on the table and let's talk about this stuff one point at a time, and let me see if I can answer those questions and if you can answer them, and together we're going to work through this, because truly I believe staying in this house and in this neighborhood for the next 5 years is in our joint best interests. We're not going to start our marriage with a deficit and another foreclosure on our credit histories. We're going to move forward and end up in a much better place, and that's what I want for you.
Very good.
You can You don't even have to quote me. You can just say it's yours.
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, Elise. You don't know. I have had those thoughts, and you don't know how good it feels to have that reinforced. Really, to tell you the truth, by someone like you with your experience. So, you know, I've never, you know, like so many people, never been in a crazy situation like this, and it's different. It's foreign. You know. This housing crash, you know.
Nobody's been in this before. This hasn't happened in 80 years. And back 80 years ago, life was a little different.
Thank you very much.
Danny?
You made my week, a month. Okay.
Well, I hope that you and your intended have many, many happy years together. Let me know how the conversation goes, okay?
I will indeed. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good Sunday. 48 minutes past the hour. This is what I love about my job, helping you rebuild your lives. 404-872-0750. I'm Elise Kling. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find Elise Kling live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
It's 12:54 on the Elise Kling Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750. Next week we're on 12-2. There's football. I don't know. There's another off or a bye week coming up. And then I've just been planning end of the year. I can't believe it. But it is the end of October this week. Happy Halloween on Thursday. If you want to see some really cool haunted houses and read about them, I'll tweet it out. I've got it on my CBS News blog this week. But we are already planning our year-end conversations about tax. And I think we are going to have a tax show, things that you need to know before the end of the year, December 8th. I think that's the date. And I will double-check that and let you know next week for sure. But you're going to want to put it on your calendar. So much great stuff coming up. And really, taxes are just a mess. Big surprise. The IRS announced this week that it is going to push back the date with that it starts accepting your tax returns. Normally, the IRS opens for business around January 15th. This year, it's going to be the end of the month and maybe even to the beginning of February. Oh, Krista Wheeler is telling me December 8th is correct. That is our tax day. So we will have our regular tax experts live in the studio answering your tax questions. But there is a lot going on with the IRS. There are all kinds of tax rule changes. There are things that you're going to need to know. Things are really changing for the beginning of the year. And one of the things at the top of the list will be the tax credits that are associated with, and the subsidies, with the Obamacare Act, the ACA. We started the show talking about that. There will definitely be more information on that December 8th when we do our tax show. 56 minutes past the hour. We just have a few questions left. A few minutes left. Patty joins me on the line from Marietta. Patty, how can I help you today?
I was just looking for some advice. I've had some water damage in my kitchen, and I have the insurance adjuster coming in tomorrow. And I'm a little nervous. I've never filed a homeowner's claim. And when they actually had to take my cabinets out, I got home and I had no kitchen. And they broke my granite, and I'm just concerned. I mean, it's a
who broke
name
the,
insurance
I'm
company.
Sorry, who broke the granite?
The people that actually came out to clean up the floor and take the cabinets down. They actually broke a piece of the granite when they were removing it to clean up the water damage.
And did you go back to the company and say, hey, you guys damaged this?
They know. My husband was there. He witnessed it.
Uh-huh.
But my concern is I do have replacement damage on the insurance, and but I'm concerned, you know, matching up granite and then staining the cabinets. And the adjuster comes tomorrow, and I haven't really had time to get other estimates, and I know they're going to have their people, and I don't know what to expect.
Yeah, you're going to have some time. So the first thing is that I'm sure you've documented all of this with video and with photos, right?
Yes, definitely.
You've taken a million photos. So the first thing that you're going to want to do is just listen to what the insurance adjuster says, and you'll hear what he has to say. And you can always contest the adjustment. You can have somebody else come back. You can hire a third-party claims administrator. So there are a lot of different things that you can do. Tomorrow isn't the last word on this, but you may just like it. And so what I encourage you to do is just take a lot of notes, listen, talk about the estimate that you have, tell them you're still working on different estimates, and see, they may have a better amount for you than you think. And really, though, you have to go back to this other company and say, you guys damaged all this stuff. What are you going to do for me as well? So it goes on both sides. Just remember, you have the right to go and find yet another claims administrator, not another one from the company, but a third party to help you fight this, just in case it doesn't go the way you want it to. 59 minutes past the hour. Music's playing. Our time is up. I'll be back next week. In the meantime, follow me on Twitter at Glink, G-L-I-N-K. Sign up for the website thinkglink.com. And remember, it's up to you. You can rebuild America as well. I'm Elise Glink. Have a great week, everybody.